partly windy as well. Out of the west is gusting as high as 30 miles an hour. Wednesday night, a low of 23 below. Thursday, sunny and cold, a high of 3 above. We eventually emerge from the deep freeze toward the end of the work week. Thursday night, expecting another below zero night of 6 below. But by Friday, we should see a high of around 20. And then for Saturday, a high near 36 with a slight chance of rain and snow. Right now, 23 in Kenosha, 24 in Racine, 21 in Lake Geneva. I'm David Cole, WGTD News. The morning show with Greg Berg is coming up.
And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I am actually recording the Monday interview on Sunday afternoon ahead of the big winter storm forecast to roll in and forecast to make the Monday morning commute very, very complicated. And so to make sure that we could secure for certain the participation of our guest, we are recording it ahead of time via the telephone. Our guest, Dr. Art Sear, such a good friend of the morning show and to WGTD, the director of the Clausen Center at Carthage College, Clausen Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business, author of After the Cold War, a popular syndicated columnist, and a monthly visitor to WGTD's morning show. And so this first visit of 2019 is over the telephone, something out of the ordinary for us. But nevertheless, I look forward to these next few minutes very much. Dr. Art Sear, Happy New Year and welcome to the morning show.
Well, Happy New Year to you, sir, and thank you for the kind and warm words. Thank you for warmth on a cold day, as the cow said to the farmer in Wisconsin long ago.
Exactly. Well, glad we can at least do it this way and make sure that...
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, that, thank you for the initiative. Thanks.
No problem at all. So we will take care of a number of big items, and of course, probably chief among them is the ending of what turned out to be the longest government shutdown in U.S. history, and what turned out to be quite a tricky and even painful situation politically for President Trump over this issue of a border wall. First of all, I wonder what your impressions were about this long government standoff and, in a sense, the effect that it had on our country as a whole and, in particular, how it seems to have been perceived by most Americans.
Well, to take the last part first, I think the other Iron Lady, Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, has certainly triumphed up to now. With 2020 hindsight, President Trump made a blunder of serious proportions in initiating this shutdown. People are unhappy about it. Regarding other parts of your question, the economy is very strong, and overall, I think the economic effect has been nil. Thank God we did not have an airline crash or any other kind of human disaster, which could have happened. And I think it was that kind of concern and pressure that led the president to give in ultimately. But an awful lot of people are inconvenienced. We live in a time when public service of all kinds is denigrated. In the U.S., that hasn't always been the case. I'm very sorry about that personally, but I think we should all keep in mind the many, many hardworking people in the public sector, including the military, who were inconvenienced not only by the shutdown, but by the president's political stunt of mobilizing and sending military forces, federal forces, to the border. It's just terrible from my point of view.
What about that point that President Trump has been trying to make, that we are in something of a crisis when it comes to the security of our southern border, our border with Mexico, and that it was a crisis of such proportions that a move this drastic was warranted because the construction of a $5.7 billion wall is, in his view, warranted.
During his first 2 years in office, when the Republicans controlled both houses of the Congress, He and they could have moved through some pretty substantial financing. No, it's a political stunt geared to the 2020 elections. Insofar as we can document these things, illegal immigration is down dramatically. I don't think there's any hard evidence for the notion of a crisis. And in fact, our integration, thanks to NAFTA, the North American regional economy is so great that the Mexican government has absolutely no interest and no incentive to go along with this political stunt. Keep in mind that the Mexicans were originally supposed to pay for this. That was what the president said repeatedly during his 2016 campaign.
Right. That ends up putting him in yet another very uncomfortable sort of political corner out of which it's difficult to extricate himself. So what would you sense is the path forward from this? I believe the agreement that was hammered out that gets the government going again is certainly a temporary measure, but it opens up then the possibility of negotiation. Do you care to hazard a guess on what those negotiations might look like or where all of this might possibly be leading?
Well, I don't know. I'm certainly no insider and shouldn't be understood as anyone who has special information regarding Washington politics. I think most Americans would be happy if, in fact, there were flexible, bipartisan willingness to negotiate seriously on both sides, and I think political credit would accrue to whoever took that stance. Obviously, the speaker is not inclined to do so. But historically speaking, it's only, I believe, in recent times that the Speaker of the House has become such a partisan office. Speaker Pelosi is such a skillful politician that she will soon exceed the very long tenure, more than 20 years, of Sam Rayburn, who was Speaker of the House from around 1940 into the 60s with two brief interruptions when the Republicans got a majority briefly during the Truman and then the Eisenhower administrations. He took a very bipartisan and inclusive stance to the office and profited therefrom. I think, especially given the low repute of not just Congress but Washington generally, on the part of the voters, I think there's an opportunity for someone to exercise that kind of leadership. But keep in mind, I'm about as far removed from being a real player as possible, an academic at a small college. But I would hope that I'm not optimistic, but I would hope that the speaker might take that approach.
I wonder if we could just stay with the question of our southern border for just a moment. I have read an interesting quote floating around, and every time I read it, the numbers within it change a little bit. But I've heard it said from a number of different people that essentially this wall being proposed by President Trump is either a third century solution or a 10th century solution or a 12th century solution to a 21st century problem. That is, it is in the view of critics a rather simplistic and out of date means to confront what really is an issue with which we need to seriously wrestle. So if a wall is not the proper solution for a so-called 21st century problem like immigration, what do you think is a more meaningful solution to our to security at our southern border?
Well, the notion that the president is pursuing a simple-minded feudal wall or kind of Great Wall of China or something like that is such a persuasive point that it's emerged as a Democratic Party talking point, which doesn't mean it's invalid, but they're trying very hard, and you're echoing that, I believe, they're trying very hard to turn that very successful campaign image of the president against him. In point of fact, border security involves people. It involves high technology. It involves physical barriers, but not just but not really an old-fashioned literal wall. And in fact, Democrats, including Senator Schumer and Speaker Pelosi, were quite responsive to initiatives of another president, Barack Obama, in appropriating some billions of dollars overall for border security. So there's certainly a physical dimension, but you're quite right, a feudal wall doesn't work. Senator Michael Bennett, a younger Democrat from Colorado, has been particularly effective as well as emphatic in pursuing this point. And I would commend to you and our listeners a video readily available online, along with lots of other things, his strong, powerful, emotional criticism of Senator Ted Cruz regarding the shutdown. Senator Cruz is notorious, among other things, for initiating a rather brief government shutdown, I think, in 2013. No, you're quite right. Border security is not solved by medieval methods. Thank you.
And it's also important to say that this is an issue that needs to be taken seriously, and that
well, sure, that's why we're discussing it
right
today.
And that and so even those that oppose the construction of a wall, in a sense, should not do so flippantly without following up with some kind of better solution of their own for how to maybe have this under better control.
Yeah. And since we're all so downbeat and negative about the matter, especially because immigrants, legal and illegal, are not some sort of center of criminal activity north of the border, that it's a compliment to the United States that so many people want to come to this country. This is a good place to live and a good place to work, and we don't hear that or talk about that nearly enough, in my view.
Hmm. I also wanted...
People want to come. Well, this is where people want to come.
Right.
John Kennedy, quite eloquently at the Berlin Wall in 1963, in hindsight, became an iconic figure in part because of his extraordinarily effective speech at the Berlin Wall, which the Soviets and their East German puppet regime erected in 61 to stanch the tremendous outflow of people from East Germany. It was so effective that President Reagan, in effect, had an encore performance of that terrific theater during the 1980s. And his main point to his staff was, let's handle this so it's effective, but I don't want to look like I'm imitating Jack Kennedy. Let's do it differently. But it's just a great, great performance. And it's a great performance because they were both inspiring political leaders, but also people want to come to this country, and people want to come to countries like us. They don't want to live like the Soviets lived.
Mm. Good point.
Keep that in mind. Thank you. I'm glad it is.
A last point on this.
It's not part of the current debate. We're right. At each other's throats politically.
Right. A last point, which is that I read this morning that the latest Associated Press poll has President Trump's approval rating at 34%, which I am pretty sure is the lowest that we have seen, which would indicate that this situation with the government standoff, as you alluded to as you began your first answer, has perhaps damaged President Trump politically in ways that he certainly did not intend.
No, I would at least agree with your last point. He obviously didn't intend it. And at the same time, there are an awful lot of our fellow Americans who are very, very strongly committed to the president, and the controversy surely reinforces his base. And he's one politician in an age when polls don't seem to be so reliable, and not just in the U.S., in our politics. He's a politician who's obviously been able to transcend polls. He's got a very committed base, and a large proportion of them obviously are people who don't answer polls, who don't show up in marketing and media radar. Keep that in mind. Richard Nixon referred to the phenomenon as the great silent majority, and he was right.
Hmm. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Dr. Art Sear, Clawson Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business at Carthage College, and my guest for Monday's morning show. We are actually recording our conversation Sunday afternoon before the onslaught of a winter storm that we feared might make Professor Sears' commute from Illinois very difficult for the early morning hours when the morning show is broadcast. So that's why we are having this Sunday afternoon conversation while the sun is still shining and before the snow comes. Professor Sear, we should also spend a bit of time talking about the mess of Brexit and the latest chapter in what has been a real ordeal for Great Britain and for Prime Minister May, with the resounding defeat of the Brexit plan that she had put together and which she hoped would allow for Britain's exit from the European Union to happen with at least some smoothness. Explain from your vantage point what in fact happened and where this leaves Britain and the European Union at this important moment.
Well, our separation of power system is very tough to manage effectively, even for a strong and skillful and brilliant president. The parliamentary system in Britain is also very hard to manage because the executive is literally integrated into the parliament, overwhelmingly but not exclusively the lower house, the House of Commons, and either system, along with every other representative government system that really works, is very hard to make work. So I think we should feel some sympathy for the Prime Minister, who's obviously committed and sincere in her efforts. But Nancy Pelosi can rightly be described as an Iron Lady, and Margaret Thatcher, to whom the term was originally applied, a very successful British Prime Minister for over a decade, starting in 1979, certainly it fit her, but unfortunately for Prime Minister May, she is not someone who is seen as an intimidating figure or a particularly powerful figure, even within her own party. In fairness to her, the Conservative Party, since a lot of younger right-wing MPs came in the general election of 1997, she was one of them. This newer generation of Conservative elected politicians tend to be very hostile to the European Union, unlike earlier Conservative leaders. And the result has been not a party uniformly against the European Union, but a party that's divided not just two ways, but in several ways against the European Union. The fact that in the 2017 election, she was hoping to strengthen a narrow Conservative majority. In fact, they lost their majority. She and her cabinet colleagues are dependent on the DUP, the Democratic Unionist Party, in Northern Ireland, which has about 10 MPs or so. They provide a very narrow majority for the government. They are extremely insistent that Northern Ireland be disrupted as little as possible as a result of British departure from the European Union. And that's further weakened her position. So she's much beleaguered and very weak. And my guess is she's probably not going to survive too much longer.
Right. So
it's a representative system, and it shows, among other, excuse me, I could go on endlessly about the EU, but I won't. It shows how fractured the British are and how ambiguous they are and have always been about Europe. They've never been really comfortable in close economic and legal as opposed to military alliance relationships with Europe.
Even ahead of the European Union, you're saying? I mean, that there's a history that stretches back long before that.
Well, they could have. Yes, indeed. The imagery of Tudor and Stuart England involves a lot of great pictures as well as writings that dramatically show how distant psychologically our British friends feel from Europe. And especially since World War II, they, of course, feel very close to the United States. But it's something that is playing out that is deeply rooted historically, like just about everything else in the British Isles.
Hmm. So as someone who really understands the global economy and how the global economy functions in this day and age, I want you to give us a sense of why Brexit matters to the world outside of Britain, and for that matter, outside of Europe. I mean, what are the potential ripple effects from Brexit, and what difference does it make in terms of how that separation actually occurs? If it's just a clean, abrupt, raw break, or something that is more of a negotiated process or so on. I mean, I guess my question boils down to what kind of harm are we trying to avoid here? Should Britain ultimately leave the European Union, as they are still on track to do?
Well, there's a lot of alarmist commentary in the media, not just from politicians, but from experienced lawyers whose clients work in Europe, corporate clients, that it's going, if not the end of the world, it's going to be too close to it, and predictions of a recession that could last for years or decades in Britain. My guess is this is not going to be what happens. The British, I think, will probably muddle through, a term for good reasons applied to their way of doing things, politically and governmentally. They don't have to leave the European Union. As recently as this last December, the European Court of Justice, a well-established European legal institution that provides a legal bedrock and foundation to the European Union, made an important decision. The British are not required to leave. European Union officials don't have to do anything for the British to remain. EU executive officials, those with any authority outside of the European Parliament, they have been very consistent in saying, well, the British can stay. They don't have to leave. So I think it's best seen as a fight within the family, an intense debate among the British, and the Europeans are quite happy to be bystanders. The British, economically, are strongly integrated with Europe. Since World War II, investment, trade has been heavily involved in Europe. Even if it is a painful and disruptive break economically, if the British leave the EU and it turns out to be quite disruptive, keep in mind that Britain, in terms of services and in terms of the nature of international business that's quite actively involved in Britain, Britain is truly a global economy and a global leader. They've never been part of the European currency, the euro. And there were lots of dire predictions that London would be replaced by Paris or some combination of Frankfurt and Zurich, but that hasn't happened in terms of banking, financial services, insurance, consulting, all kinds of things. London remains a global center, and I think that would continue to be the case if there were a painful Brexit. I don't want to go on too long, even for me, but it is a complicated subject. The pound has been weakening against the dollar, but big multinational corporations that are based primarily in Britain and who do business wherever possible, primarily in British pounds, are doing quite well. Corporate profits are up. British Petroleum, Unilever, which is a global but Britain-based firm, HSBC, an enormous bank, all kinds of corporations are doing extremely well despite the uncertainty related to Brexit. I'll stop there, but my strong sense is it's not going to be the end of the world economically.
Well, that's
even for the kind of fumbling around British.
Very good. It's interesting how the British seem to be absorbing all of the headlines related to the European Union, and I'm wondering, from time to time we see signs of unrest or trouble or weakness in other countries who are a part of the EU. It seems like there have not been too many in the way of those kind of disconcerting headlines as of late. Like I said, maybe it's just because the news out of Britain has dominated the headlines maybe and shunted all of the other news off to the side. But by and large, is the European Union itself in solid shape at the moment?
I think so, because they have such a powerful economic incentive to stay together. And you're quite right. Italy, Greece, Spain, France, other countries. The Germans have a certain kind of extremist problem, but the Latin countries I just mentioned are having all kinds of difficulties that are not true of the British. That's actually quite an insightful point, put very succinctly. So maybe next time I should interview you.
I don't think we need that.
Very well put. Very insightful.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Dr. Art Sear, director of the Clausen Center at Carthage College and a monthly visitor to WGTD's morning show. And we are touching on a number of important topics. Yet another item that has been in the headlines as of late has been the continued unrest in the nation of Venezuela. I wonder if you could just say a word about the significance of a place like Venezuela, and to what extent is this something that we in the United States should be feeling significant concern about?
Well, it's a major oil producer. They're a member of OPEC, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, the oil cartel that isn't so strong anymore, but had the whip hand in the 1970s during the oil shocks of 73 and 79, which drastically fueled inflation and helped bring on significant global recession that people overlook nowadays. They are recently speaking a real thorn in the side of U.S. foreign policy because Hugo Chavez, the extreme nationalist, certainly in practical terms pro-communist, de facto dictator of Venezuela for many years, was extremely hostile to the U.S. and, like Castro's Cuba, supported left-wing radical and revolutionary movements elsewhere in the region. The fact that the Venezuelan economy is now a shambles provides yet another nail in the coffin of that particular approach to the world. Marxism in terms of extremist movements or nationalization of industry is essentially dead. I don't think Venezuela represents a major national security threat to the U.S. in today's world, but they're a very large economy, and if they continue to be in economic chaos, that could be a problem for the Americas generally.
Right. And
the Trump administration, excuse me.
Yeah.
I tend to talk too much, and I appreciate your tolerance.
No problem.
The Trump administration directly reflects this. The quip is that Maduro is one dictator so bad even President Trump doesn't like him. And the U.S. government has spearheaded the effort to get him out of office. So far, working well, I think.
That is, Maduro is in increasingly desperate political trouble.
Right, exactly.
It will be interesting to see how long he holds on. In contrast, one of your most recent columns celebrated a very, very different kind of leader. In fact, one could hardly imagine a starker contrast between the president of Venezuela and the head of South Korea. And I think you, in this column, quite rightly pointed out the fact that sometimes it is these relatively quiet and extremely effective leaders whom we do not stop to appreciate. So I want to give you a real opportunity to tell our listeners about this remarkable leader of South Korea.
You're referring to President Moon Jae-in.
Right. And
who currently is rather unpopular publicly, but that's that goes along with the territory when you're an elected politician. He doesn't dominate the headlines the way our president and the leader of Kim Jong-un, the leader of North Korea, definitely not an elected leader, do. And his name isn't mentioned much at all in connection with the upcoming meeting that will probably come off between President Trump and Kim next month. But he, behind the scenes, has been brokering steadily improving relationships between Washington and Pyongyang, and shows a dramatic demonstration, thanks for asking, of the fact that even in today's media world, an awful lot of the important stuff of government goes on behind the scenes.
Right. It reminds me of a point that you made ahead of President Trump's first meeting with the leader of North Korea, when you said that ideally those kind of meetings that occur in front of the cameras, in the spotlight, are the culmination of a great deal of hard work that has gone on behind the scenes. And those kind of moments then are celebratory of something that has been accomplished. And of course, that particular meeting wasn't exactly that. It was certainly significant because there had been little or no connection whatsoever between our two governments. So just making a connection at all was in itself significant, but it did not, in a sense, represent anything particularly substantive, and especially nothing that had been brokered behind the scenes the way in which, for instance, there have been all kinds of negotiations between North and South Korea that the rest of the world has paid very little attention to, but that matter a great deal when it comes to the relationship between these two neighbors and the safety of all the other nations that surround them.
Well, that's a very interesting point you make. Again, I, in the column you're referring to, I think I was referring to the fact that an enormous amount of staff work is done for any kind of meeting between the top-level leaders to come off successfully. And I dare say that's true in the corporate world and other kinds of arenas beyond government. But I was referring to the fact that U.S. summits with other countries that work well depend a lot on disciplined presidential leadership. And I believe in our particular system, George H.W. Bush and Richard Nixon and Jimmy Carter, believe it or not, were particularly effective in that regard. What you're making is a more imaginative point, that in a globalized world, on which I'm not an expert, I assure you, and nobody else is either, particularly close allies of the U.S. can perform a similar role that's really important. And the South Koreans have done that historically, starting with World War II and starting with intelligence cooperation, in my opinion. The British have played an extremely important and largely behind-the-scenes role vis-a-vis the U.S. So you're kind of putting a different perspective on what I wrote about concerning President Moon.
Interesting.
I'm very glad you brought him up. He was a human rights lawyer who was sufficiently active and effective to be arrested and imprisoned when he was very young by the brutal long-term dictatorship of General Park Chung-hee in South Korea. But he also served in the South Korean Army and was a special forces soldier who saw action in under fire in the DMZ at the 38th parallel. He's a person who's accomplished a lot and can be a pretty inclusive leader in South Korea.
Right, and with a complicated and ultimately pretty impressive resume, actually.
And unlike Kim Jong-un and unlike the President of the United States currently, if I may say so, he actually knows what military service is like. He knows what military combat is like, a different dimension on life that's educational, to be sure. And I believe that's directly reflected in his effectiveness so far on the international stage.
Very good. Finally, I want to be sure to give you a chance to expound on a column of yours that I enjoyed reading, in part because it certainly echoed comments that you have made time and time again in your visits to WGTD, namely the propensity for media companies of all shapes and sizes and stripes to tend to deliver the news and slant the news and focus the news in such a way as to be fairly alarmist and attention-grabbing headlines and so on, and sometimes neglecting quieter but more significant stories that we all need to be paying more attention to. But in particular, in this column, you, I think, write very effectively about the importance of the average citizen not getting too caught up in some of these headlines that the world of media tends to generate nowadays. Tell us more about the kind of work of the media that most concerns you in this respect.
Well, I've been writing a weekly column, thanks to Howard Brown initially at the Kenosha News when I first came to Carthage back in 98. Tom Clausen, the namesake of our graduate trustee and the namesake of the center you were kind enough to mention at Carthage, particularly liked newspaper columns as a way of getting our name out to the world at large. It's tough to write a column every week, and I do it partly by shamelessly stealing material from all kinds of other writers. However, unlike some journalists and others, I do my best to give credit, and I was actually inspired by a column, I think on January 3rd, in the Wall Street Journal by Greg Ip, I-P, India Papa, I-P, a relatively young journalist, I think from Canada, who wrote a column about emphasizing how things are getting better. It wasn't on page one of the journal, but it was only a couple of pages in the actual newspaper. And one telling statistic that he emphasized that I wasn't previously aware of is that as recently as 1980, about half the world's population lived in dire, desperate poverty, meaning dire poverty. You don't know whether you're going to have a meal for the survive for the next week or so because food is at a premium and hard to get and not very clean or nutritious. You don't know whether you're going to be able to continue living or not. The bare minimum, which the World Bank estimates is something I think under $2 a day, measured in 2011 dollar values, that was not available to about at least half the world's population. Last year, people in that situation, and global statistics today are relatively reliable, was down under 10%. At the same time that our population has expanded dramatically, the vast majority of people are now able to live in something that Americans would consider a reasonable way of life. And so I developed a column, assembled some other information and comments on that point. That, of course, doesn't make news headlines. And in the increasingly pervasive 24/7 nonstop news cycle, that kind of basic good information tends to get shunted aside, I think, more than was the case in the past.
Right, and you know, you call it good.
Remarkable change.
Yeah, and you call it good information, and in a sense, it's also good news or quiet good news, but it's as though we don't have time for that, and it seems to me part of the point is not just we should pay attention to that so we feel better, but we should pay attention to it because it's true. And the only way we can better understand the world in which we live and foster even more good things for more people is to really understand the world we are living in right now and what life is like for most of the people who live on this planet, and understand better what has been accomplished and what remains to be done. And getting caught up in the wrong kind of headlines while ignoring this other truth, that leaves all of us ignorant in a way that seems to me is pretty dangerous.
Yeah, you're quite right. At the same time that information and misinformation is pervasive, we have more choice than ever before in what kind of information we absorb. That's a big change from even a few decades ago. And I think we have more responsibility than ever before to separate good information from bad, because it's pervasive and it's easier than ever before to kind of segregate yourself into your own electronic cocoon and your own immediate circle of people so that your own point of view is reinforced.
Hmm.
And we've got to avoid that.
Right.
I'm a real freak about free speech and the First Amendment. Partly for moral reasons, but also for practical reasons. You survive as a society over the long term only if you, and an individual, only if you're open to the information you least want to hear, the viewpoints that you find most unattractive. It's extremely important to grapple with those.
Hmm. As you were talking about this general rise of the standard of living all around the globe in a way that really is gratifying to see, and one wants to see it continue, it does remind me of a recent interview I did specifically on the topic of energy. And in line with concerns around climate change. And this author raised a point that I had not really stopped to think about, which is that as more of the globe, more of the citizens of the world rise out of abject poverty and out of kind of a third world existence into something more closely resembling the kind of lives that we enjoy in this country, for instance, that there is going to be an escalating need for energy, and that energy is a big part of what makes life better for people. And so while we can celebrate that, it also is a sobering reality with which we're going to have to wrestle, is where is all of this additional energy going to come from?
Yeah, and it's one reason why the market for green, environmentally responsible energy sources is growing dramatically, and I mean really dramatically, in billion-dollar terms around the globe. John Kerry, the former senator and secretary of state and Democratic presidential nominee in 2004, is keenly interested in this subject. He gave the annual lecture at Ditchley Park, an Anglo-American but also international conference center in Oxford, not too far from the university, a couple of years ago. And the text, which I believe is readily available on the Ditchley Park website, provides chapter and verse on the degree to which the private sector actually is becoming increasingly, in response to the market forces you mentioned, a more and more powerful provider of not just petroleum energy and not just coal energy, but clean energy, which clearly is the future for the planet as the population expands. Dire predictions in the past, Robert McNamara, who was defense secretary in the 60s, thanks to President Lyndon Johnson, became president of the World Bank. He was Tom Clawson's predecessor there. McNamara served for over a decade, a remarkably long tenure at the World Bank, and gave tremendous emphasis to problems of, to his credit, the problems of the poorest countries in the world. He also was obsessed with statistics, if I might say so. And he's left us a very rich legacy, not only of aid to the poor, which Tom Clawson, his successor, greatly expanded with much less public visibility. But McNamara left us a library of speeches in the 1970s that predicted dire consequence for the world of the population explosion. That has not come to pass. And my view is historically the most alarmist predictions have tended not to come to pass. It's something to keep in mind, in particular when reading and talking with and interviewing people who are committed to the environmental movement and tend to have a rather pessimistic view of the future.
Interesting. To finish out, since we're at the start of a new year, I wonder what your advice would be to people listening to our conversation in terms of news stories that you would like people to pay more attention to. What are the kind of things that people just need to have a higher level of awareness about, and maybe watching and listening and just being more inquisitive about?
Well, I wasn't expecting this question.
Yeah, I'm surprising you.
Professor Berg, I'm a college professor, which means I'm really good at predicting the past and second-guessing and evaluating and critiquing what's already happened.
Right. Just to be clear, I'm not asking you to predict what's going to happen in 2019. It's more just what are the kinds of things we just don't tend to pay enough attention to that the average American should pay more attention to?
Not-for-profit organizations, which sounds kind of un-American, but you have government, you have business, you have the church, in the West especially the Roman Catholic Church. You have the not-for-profit sector, these kind of amorphous organizations that aren't fish or fowl, aren't either one. It's a very British way of going about things. They have a strong, rich tradition of moving beyond the state and the church and their activity. We inherited that. Not-for-profit organizations, service organizations of all kinds, are growing exponentially. They generally pay a lot better than they used to, and they're involved in an enormous array of important good works, not just advocacy, but actually rolling up your sleeves and doing service. You and I have the benefit of being around the future in terms of our students. And one thing that impresses me at Carthage, but also elsewhere, is their strong commitment to service activities. The other thing to pay attention to is the degree to which the rule of law, not necessarily the common law, which we inherited from the British and is very different from the continent of Europe, but the adversarial, relatively open, relatively fair proceedings in court, in which ideally there's a jury, from my point of view, but not necessarily, adversarial, orderly rule of law, the degree to which that is becoming a more common practice around the world. Russia is a brutal and dictatorial autocracy, but Putin not only has to have elections, they do have a court system, and they do have trials, especially in commercial conflicts and commercial life. They actually do have a legal process that's moving more along the lines of what we do. I had cause to reflect on this over the weekend because I just got back late last night from Loras College. Our fine mock trial team did extraordinarily well for over a decade. This, in effect, lawyer-like practice, courtroom practice, a very intense kind of debate program, has been overseen by our colleague Mike Fegley, who is a municipal judge in Mount Pleasant and a practicing lawyer, and currently Court Commissioner Larry Keating from Kenosha helps him. It's not just that our students did extraordinarily well this time around, as they have in the past for a small college, but also you really get a sense of how important this educational dimension is for young people. And it reflects the fact that it's an inevitable part of our society, but it's the best way to handle conflicts, and it's becoming worldwide. You have to look closely to get beyond the personalities and the rhetoric, but news stories that involve adversarial proceedings within the law, involving governments, involving corporations, involving individuals, that the degree to which the rule of law is becoming more pervasive, I think, is going to be an important barometer in 2019 of where we're going. That's a clear point. But the nonprofit sector, which we Americans tend to overlook, along with a lot of other people, and what we call the rule of law, those are two things to pay attention to.
Well, we'll certainly try to do our part here on the morning show, and for that matter, in these conversations, which it is my pleasure to conduct with you each and every month. Dr. Art Sear, Director of the Clausen Center, Clausen Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business, thank you for being part of the morning show today.
Well, thank you for the invitation.
News from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio coming up. First, the forecast from the National Weather Service. That winter storm warning remains in